how can you even exist? I how can somebody get from Pelican Bay to Berkeley? How can you go from, you know, the most coercive, destructive arm of the state to its most sort of uplifting, you know, aspirational side? I mean, how do you make that journey, right? And to me, it was almost an earth-shattering moment to realize that people were doing that.
San Quentin is one of America's most notorious prisons for a variety of reasons. Located in Marin County, just across the Richmond Bridge from the East Bay, the male-only prison is the oldest prison in California, built in 1842. The complex consists of 432 acres and currently incarcerates people at 105% of its design capacity, with over 3,200 occupants. It's the state's only death row prison, meaning any man condemned to death in California must be held at San Quentin. In 2001, San Quentin death row was described as the largest in the Western Hemisphere. The entire states of Florida and Texas held fewer death row inmates than San Quentin in 2009. But it's also called the Disneyland of the prison system because of the numbers of programs coming through. For people involved in abolition or criminal justice reform in California, San Quentin is a logical starting point. Overpopulated, majority people of color, and many planning to spend the remainder of their life inside the complex, San Quentin has become the example of everything the system represents. At UC Berkeley, San Quentin seems like a world away. What is the connection between these parallel institutions across the bay? If UC Berkeley is meant to produce the next generation of bright minds, social change, San Quentin has built to house those the criminal system has deemed unfit for general society. But the relationship is far more apparent than we might realize. A UC Berkeley professor interested in criminology and the sociology of law, Jonathan Simon, explained to me why it's important to understand these two institutions as connected and what they can say about America more generally.
Kind of like today, people are seeing the prison not just as a particular bad institution, but as kind of a microcosm for sort of racism and the larger structure of, you know, inequality in society.
Since 2013, Simon has directed Berkeley's Interdisciplinary Center for the Study of Law and Society.
But I think you have to start at the beginning. So, you know, the state was, you know, conquered by America, you know, taken away from Mexico, and I think the War of 1848. It becomes a state because of the gold rush by 1850. And by 1851, they've started building San Quentin. So, we didn't have a capital at that point. You know, we definitely didn't have a university. To my knowledge, we didn't have a state mental hospital. In some ways, the very first thing that the state did to sort of manifest itself as a state was to create a prison.
Creating a prison as its first manifestation of statehood is telling in California's aspirations at the time, and as Berkeley is the state's university doesn't come along until 18 years later. By the time Berkeley comes into its own at the beginning of the 20th century, the prison and the university create a relationship largely based on a pseudoscientific view of criminology, largely rooted in eugenics. This view of eugenics believed most social problems are inherited traits, and by screening out those populations from society, you could solve larger societal issues. This is obvious in a lot of immigration policies and sterilization programs at the time, which described Western and Northern Europeans as the most desirable population.
One of the areas that eugenics probably had the most influence on was penology, and the idea that instead of just locking people in cells for the crimes that they've committed, you could look at them as sort of individual specimens, and with this kind of eugenic racist science in mind, you could use the prison system to essentially remove some people from society while returning others who you deem to be sort of rehabilitatable. And so it's around this time, basically the early 20th century, that San Quentin and Folsom as well go through a big change that's sort of influenced by Berkeley, I would say, which is they introduce the life sentence what's called the indeterminate sentence. So you commit a felony and suddenly, instead of being sentenced to like 5 years in Folsom or San Quentin, you're sentenced to life in prison with the idea that you can be paroled if you're rehabilitated. But looked at through the eugenic lens, their intention was to be able to sort of select out the dangerous few. And so that was really important because over time and very much today, San Quentin has become a refuge, if you will, but a site where people serving life sentences spend a great deal of the latter years. It's one of the reasons I think the education program has flourished, because lifers are, I think, the graduate students in a way of the prison population.
So in the earlier years, the relationship of the institutions was more from Berkeley into the prison, primarily with this dominant racial science. If you leap forward into the 60s, Berkeley had become known as a home for the rebirth of the political resistance. And then in this phase, the relationship between the two institutions transforms once again.
And it's really a remarkable chapter in the history of the two institutions, because at this time there's also quite a vital, vibrant movement inside prisons, partly the product of increasing incarceration of radicalized black and brown youth and young people who are being incarcerated. And instead of just accepting the prison as it is, they begin to really conceive an almost revolutionary abolitionist sort of agenda. And this is a moment where there's a real synergy, you might say, between especially the student body at Berkeley and the people inside prison and their community of supporters on the outside. There's really a kind of there's really a kind of dynamic that opens up where students from the Berkeley campus are going over to San Quentin and protesting. People coming out of the prisons are coming and speaking to students here on campus.
As a history largely beginning in the world of eugenics, the relationship between Berkeley and San Quentin has always existed. The nature of the relationship, however, has changed over time.
One of the things that kind of builds that, in some ways, the radicalization of the population inside prison begins, it's kind of tied to that earlier phase of the life sentence and the idea of parole and rehabilitation, because by the time you get to the 1950s, the eugenic era has been kind of pushed into the background with some embarrassment, and instead the system is promoting itself as very interested in rehabilitating people. And one of the main ways, one of the only tools really they have to rehabilitate people is reading. They basically start educating people who, you know, need the education. They actually had a pretty good high school and even, I think mostly high school, but the beginnings of some college available in the 50s. But more importantly, the prisoners who could already read had this incentive to educate themselves, because they would literally, the librarians at San Quentin would keep track of how many books you read. And so you really got this sort of interesting dynamic where Berkeley and San Quentin are becoming similar in the sense that they are both places where the sort of subject population has this huge incentive and the ability and the time to become learned and to engage in a kind of intellectual ferment. And this actually helps to produce the radicalization of the population inside San Quentin, because you get figures like George Jackson, the famous leader of the San Quentin uprising, who died in 1971, who came into prison, you know, not having finished high school and literate, but I think, you know, not at all educated. And he ends up being like a world famous political theorist.
The mention of the San Quentin uprising refers to an escape attempt in 1971. George Jackson was one of six people killed during this attempt. He was the co-founder of the Black Gorilla family and writer of the Soledad Brothers. He was serving an indeterminate sentence within San Quentin for stealing $70 from a gas station. This event changed a lot of public perspective on San Quentin. Although figures like George Jackson aimed to increase solidarity between the world inside and outside the prison system, there still maintained a general lack of empathy between UC Berkeley and San Quentin until what Simon describes as a few crucial events in the 90s, and also likely due to the general public's increased understanding of mass incarceration and its link to race in America. This takes us into the 90s and the era of mass incarceration.
Partly as a result of that uprising, partly as a result of growing political support for kind of a war on crime, which has a very racial, you know, dimension to it. California becomes one of the first states to repudiate the idea of rehabilitation, having been one of the most, committed to it. We actually put into the penal code that the purpose of prison is punishment. We develop a whole new set of prisons without any pretense to rehabilitating people. And I would say in that era, sort of the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, there's a kind of wall between San Quentin and Berkeley, and really a wall between the prison system and the civil society as a whole. People aren't thinking about prisons. There's not much of a movement in support of imprisoned people. Prison sentences have gotten so long that there's much less kind of traffic back and forth that there had been in an earlier period. And so I think of this as a period of kind of, unawareness, or where there's a real lack of empathy or connection between the university and the prison system and its population. And I think, I don't know when you would sort of draw the line and say, well, this is the turning point, but there's a couple of events in the 90s that are important. Certainly the Critical Resistance is founded in 1998. Are you familiar with that organization?
Could you explain it a little
bit? Critical Resistance is essentially an abolitionist movement of people from the communities that are heavily, heavily afflicted by incarceration, activists and radical intellectuals, especially from the black feminist tradition, like Angela Davis, Ruth Wilson Gilmore are some of the most prominent names. Well, those two and many others, like Beth Ritchie, another great activist scholar, came, and it was here in Berkeley in 1998 to have the first conference that anyone had had since, you know, the 70s, to bring together activists and sort of researchers to talk about how to end, how to resist mass incarceration and maybe prisons altogether. And I think they anticipated that a couple hundred people would come, and they ended up with like over 1,000. So this, you know, that's one of the moments. Another moment for me was the beginnings of USI.
USI stands for Underground Scholars Initiative, and we'll expand on it later in the podcast, but this group started at UC Berkeley in the early 2000s in order to build a community for formerly incarcerated individuals on campus. Danny Murillo is currently the director of the program, and Simon describes meeting Danny as a transformative moment for him as an educator.
And he was sitting, you know, so I was already in this office, so it must have been 2008, 2009, sitting right where you were, and he introduced himself and said, "My name is Danny Murillo. I've been in Pelican Bay SHU, you know, for most of the last 10 years, and now I'm here at Berkeley, and I understand you work on prisons, and I really wanted to meet you." And I was like, how can you even exist?
That is the moment at the very beginning of the podcast, where Simon describes meeting Danny and seeing how formerly incarcerated students are shaping the current relationship Berkeley has with the prison system. USI stands for Underground Scholars Initiative, a program building a prison-to-university pipeline for the community. Amongst increased general awareness and teachings in departments like ethnic studies, formerly incarcerated students have come into UC Berkeley to change the way that we view prison on this campus.
They've accumulated a great force in numbers and intellectual content, and I would say that they've helped transform in many ways the intellectual content of what's thinking and teaching and writing about the penal system that we're doing at the university. So I'd like to think we're in the sort of the most interesting phase where the two institutions are in a relationship again. Activists are an important part of that.
In a lot of ways, if we were to think of this current phase, we are in the opposite place we were in the 80s, where a lack of empathy and understanding was deeply felt on campus. Simon believes that when he first started teaching undergraduate students on Berkeley's campus about the prison system and its impact on society, the biggest struggle was addressing some of these misconceptions that students had on the prison system and the purpose of its role in society. But as students on Berkeley have increasingly become aware of the prison system and a lot of the injustices that it perpetuates, the struggle has become bringing new information that these students don't already have a pretty good understanding about. But this new struggle also brings with it a sense of hope. As Berkeley students are going into prominent circles in the future in politics, the law, philosophy, or whatever else, Simon feels confident that a lot of them already have a pretty good understanding of empathy and compassion for those within the prison system. And that can bring about a lot of change. So returning back to the USI, the Underground Scholars Initiative started on Berkeley's campus, I want to introduce one of the current scholars, Cesar Garcia.
So the Underground Scholars Initiative started in 2013. I've been involved with USI since 2015. But it came from, but not necessarily wasn't born from, but it was a spinoff of prison hunger strikes that happened in 2010 through 13.
Cesar tells me that these hunger strikes were from prisoners who felt that the prison wasn't providing the basic needs, such as education, medical assistance, and proper nutrition. Some of these people were confined 23 hours a day in their cell. These struggles are part of America's largest prison hunger strike ever, with over 30,000 participants, and unfortunately some people passed. But some of the organizers who were organizing during these strikes left and started USI, with a variety of programs aiming at creating a supportive environment and also addressing very practical needs. USI has been successful in filling gaps the institution has failed to provide. Beginning at UC Berkeley, USI is now statewide and helps students all across the state. Their programs include helping formerly incarcerated students transfer to any UC and providing assistance in which classes are needed for a transfer. They also have healing clinics every Friday with resources such as massage and acupuncture. And recently, they've celebrated some legislative success.
So if you paroled to San Diego, but you got accepted to Berkeley, probation officer or parole officer might not let you go to Berkeley because you're on probation, but we helped pass a bill that says that once you get accepted to a university or get a good job, that you're able to transfer. So that we got rid of that barrier. But those are just some of the things that we've done politically.
One USI program that has really expanded beyond USI and into the broader campus community is the Teach in Prison Decal, where Berkeley students go into San Quentin and tutor currently incarcerated folks and assist them in getting their GED. Caesar has plans to be one of the next facilitators of this program.
So then, in terms of the Teach in Prison program, I kind of wanted to know a little bit more on your perspective of why you think this program is really important or why you chose to get involved in it. Because I understand that you're going to be the facilitator next year.
Yeah. Yes.
Congrats.
Thanks.
But yeah, so what really inspired you to join Teach in Prison?
When I originally first got here in 2019, I had to take a leave of absence. I got in trouble and, you know, things happen. And I enrolled to be a tutor for Teach in Prison. I wasn't able to do it at the moment. And so when I got back, which was just in last spring, I came back and I facilitated Rethinking the War on Drugs. And I really liked how that happened. And then so I figured that I'd try Teach in Prison, but not as a facilitator because I signed up as a tutor. And I'm still on probation, so I wasn't allowed to tutor. But then some of the facilitators, like Ashley, she asked me if I would like to join to facilitate. And I did, and it just kind of opened the door for me to involve myself a little bit more in what I feel I can help people understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to notice that some USI members wanted to be more involved, but because of the pandemic, there was a break in how that was happening. And so I figured that if I was gonna apply myself to anything for the last year, that it should be to kind of reunite Teach in Prison and USI to be able to move forward. And to also include Rethinking the War on Drugs, because I'm also facilitating that this coming semester too. So kind of just because all those three things kind of make sense together,
mm-hmm.
and how we can utilize all three as a political base, if anything, if we need to be able to mobilize. So aside from it being academic, aside from us wanting it to be more community-based, it's also a political mobilization point where we can all come together with three entities to be able to mobilize.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a bigger dream that I hope to have with a Teach in Prison.
Yeah, and then that seems like you're doing a lot within Berkeley and Underground Scholars here. And then I guess my final question is for people who are still within San Quentin, why do you feel maybe that Teach in Prison is something really important to continue for people who are still incarcerated?
Sure. Yeah, this is it's an interesting thing because I kind of conflict with the state like very hard all the time, and this is indifferent, right? So like this is indifferent in terms of what Teach in Prison can do, because I feel like Teach in Prison tutors are somewhat oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
Like someone in prison would be oppressed on what they can learn and at what rate they can learn and why they're learning and who it's learning for, because a lot of times the state will want to say they're rehabilitating people, but it isn't for that. It's for the numbers that they need to be able to get state funding, right? And so I feel like if I know how the state works, and I've been in prison like three times, and I've done like 7 years in and out, like I totally understand how a teacher who may not have known exactly how to connect with me would have just offered me a thing to read, but a teacher who would have known that it was more about me reading and applying that to a bigger picture where then I can be free myself, then I would rather have that. And if I can do that and instill that value in people that are going to be tutors, then there's a world of possibility that could be done, not with just the tutors, but more so with people that are in prison.
Fostering dignity within those in St. Quentin is central to the mission of the Teach in Prison program. With origins in the underground scholars, Teach in Prison has deep roots in the Ethnic Studies Department and recruits students from all backgrounds interested in teaching, abolition, criminal justice reform, and activism in the Bay Area. The class is also a DECAL, which stands for Democratic Education at Cal. This means that it's entirely student-run and facilitated. This is crucial to understanding the amount of student-led effort that is going into maintaining this program. The group consists of approximately 5 facilitators who plan the logistics and facilitate the once-a-week classroom meetings, and 40 tutors who attend those once-a-week meetings and also enter St. Quentin once a week to tutor in a particular school subject. Democratic and largely non-hierarchical, everyone contributes to the success of the program, but 2 people currently involved in the leadership of the cohort gave me their perspective on the program.
Right. Hi, I'm Kenesha. I'm an organizer with Teach in Prison, and I've been involved with the program for a year now.
Hi, I'm Victoria Robinson. I'm the faculty sponsor of the Teach in Prison program and faculty in the Department of Ethnic Studies. I've been with the program for almost 7 years.
As Caesar explained, the Underground Scholars was largely started by students at UC Berkeley who were formerly incarcerated themselves. But Teach in Prison was largely started by system-impacted students at UC Berkeley who had loved ones in the prison system, either currently or in the past.
Teach in Prison has been on campus for 22 years and was begun by students who had felt the effects of targeted mass incarceration and the state surveillance and had loved ones also who were incarcerated and wanted to think about how, being at UC Berkeley, there could be an effective program that could support those who are still incarcerated. And that philosophy continues today. That's what drives the program, to think about how we can build bridges across institutions, particularly institutions of higher education and ones of incarceration, because they are in many ways embedded.
Although the program is celebrating its 22nd year, it's only the 20th year of entering St. Quentin after a brief hiatus during COVID. And according to Victoria, there was a tangible impact in the years that Berkeley did not enter the prison.
I think we can reflect on the impact of Teach in Prison by a quick story about when the program was returning after COVID. So we couldn't go in during COVID. We couldn't have those close contacts with people who were incarcerated. But when we were arranging to come back in, when the prison was opening up again, I happened to go in, was talking to the principal about thinking of the program coming back. And a couple of guys who knew me from prior to COVID just threw their hands up in the air and said, "Is Berkeley back?" And they were so excited to think that the students from UC Berkeley were going to be back with them. Because of what Kenesha named, is that there are a lot of volunteer programs in San Quentin, but UC Berkeley students show up in a very specific way. They're younger, they're students often who identify with the ways that people have been brought into the carceral state, and students of color, and the guys really, really feel closely supported by the students. So UC Berkeley coming back after COVID was such a highlight and breath of fresh air, and it was great to see their enthusiasm for us being back.
Yeah, and I think that the way that this university often wants us to function is more by building theoretical knowledge. It's not, oh, what is the reality of prisons, but rather looking at policies or looking at things at a very abstract level. And I think that this program is really powerful because it lets us actually connect with the community. And I think it's important because also you're having students come in who are actually matching the demographics, who actually have lived experience with those that are incarcerated. And I think that there's a lot of other programs that also do similar kinds of work, but those don't often have those same demographics.
Although Teach in Prison is run by college students, it is not a college education program. It is helping people receive their GED, the equivalent to a high school diploma. According to the Correctional Education Association, the illiteracy for adult inmates is estimated at 75%. Although this is a nationwide statistic, prisons across the U.S. have a shockingly high illiteracy rate.
There's a lot of great work that is happening right now that has been driven by formerly incarcerated people of understanding more sharply what people need who are incarcerated. But at the same time, there's a lot of media attention on the idea of those who are incarcerated receiving college degrees and somehow being legible to others of having great intellectual capacity, of being valuable to society, of fully reintegrating in very so-called useful ways. But I think what a lot of people don't know is that there is a close correlation between the failure of K through 12 education and incarceration. And a lot of people who are incarcerated are not in college degree programs. They're in basic education programs, basic literacy programs. And that is the bread and butter, the rubber hits the road of people's lives and how they can be glued in to new systems that can care for them, that can care for each other. So a lot of the work that is needed in incarceration, in incarcerated settings, is work of fulfilling and filling the gaps that K through 12 has failed.
Education is undeniably linked to incarceration. The commonly named school-to-prison pipeline describes the disproportionate number of poor and minority students with limited educational opportunities who end up in prison compared to their wealthier, whiter counterparts who have better-funded school systems. And as Caesar described, education is key to understanding our opportunities, the world around us, and create a community within the prison. Besides educational benefits, there are very practical benefits as well. Attending these educational classes can count towards good behavior and decrease sentences and provide increased opportunities when you exit the prison.
Yeah, naming that it comes from a DECAL is really important. So DECAL stands for Democratic Education at Cal. And really, the whole program was naming the fact that the curriculum, so-called, actually doesn't contain everything that it needs to, and students name that. And they constantly, semester by semester, build spaces through the DECAL program to fill in the gaps that exist, that is really kind of starkly present for a lot of students. What's also really important about Teach in Prison is that it's about, it contains students who've experienced intimately, proximately, very deep scars from incarceration, and those ongoing traumas that come with it. But at the same time, it also brings students who want a critical political analysis and want to do something about that with that analysis that have never experienced incarceration. So it's a unique space where it's giving and loving and kind and critical and deep and thoughtful, and it's building a kind of community that, and it's not overblown to say this, lives with you for a lifetime. We've had students who took the DECAL 22 years ago, whose lives now as doctors, as criminal justice reformers, as engineers, as accountants, has been colored by the ways in which they experienced this DECAL program. And that's pretty unique, I think.
Yeah, so I mean, kind of building off of what I mentioned earlier, I think that this work is so powerful because it's actually like us making those connections with the community. I think that we're within this ivory tower that really just wants us to gatekeep knowledge, and it's really powerful because it lets us actually build those connections and have more of a mutual relationship. And I think also it's powerful because it helps us rethink where knowledge comes from. I think that we're taught that knowledge just comes from articles and books, but if you're actually engaging with the program, there's so much knowledge that's within every single person, both within those that you're interacting with who are incarcerated, but also the great community that you find in Teach in Prison itself. We're trying to have like a more discussion-based facilitation within the power of the program is that education is, it's a community effort. It's every single one of us having a conversation with each other. And I think it's also really powerful because it gives us the space to think of a better world together. We're thinking about how do you engage with the community in a way that's mutualistic and not exploitative. And I think just having to think through all of these questions about what does it mean to build a community from scratch and what does it mean to build one that's radical? And that means radical care and radical love, but also literally radical and wanting to actually like make a genuine impact in the community around us, I think is so powerful.
And with deep roots in the underground scholars, every decal on campus is supported by a faculty and the department the faculty is a part of. Victoria teaches within ethnic studies, so this decal is currently sponsored through the ethnic studies department. The history of ethnic studies is deeply connected to the Teach in Prison program.
Department of Ethnic Studies is 50 years old. It's founded by the Third World Liberation Front. It's a struggle that was meant to hold the university accountable to communities of color who'd been excised and excluded from higher education, in particular R1 universities like UC Berkeley. The decal, Teach in Prison, is the embodiment of all the hopes and dreams that we had from the Third World Liberation Front that have been realized by students' activism, students' voices, and students' energy all the way up until the present time as we've come back into San Quentin after the COVID epidemic.
San Quentin has recently been in the news because of Governor Newsom's latest plan to transform San Quentin into what he believes the prison system in California could be. He announced his plan a few months ago to rename San Quentin State Prison to San Quentin Rehabilitation Center in an effort to bring California closer to the Scandinavian dream of quote-unquote fair prisons. San Quentin is currently focused on maximum security, but Newsom's first-of-its-kind plan has received criticism from all sides. Some argue that it's a waste of money, with estimates of this plan costing upwards of $650 million, and others argue that even with the money, it'll be a far cry from the Swedish prison system. Without even prompting, both Jonathan Simon and Caesar brought up their concerns with this current plan because it seems like it's on everyone's mind.
The humanitarian version of what San Quentin is supposed to be like, right? Like the Governor Newsom is really pushing that. And I just wanted to make it clear that that prison has been not so violent for many years. Like, it hasn't been a prison where a lot of people are sent that are, they need a little bit more disciplinary, whatever they would call it, right? That prison isn't like that and hasn't been for long yet, a lot. And the reason that there's a lot of programs there isn't really because of Newsom, it's because we're in the Bay Area and a lot of people have been focused to do those things in San Quentin. So I just wanted to help demystify what they're trying to do as opposed to what's already been done. And with some of those things have been done through Teach in Prison.
Unsurprisingly, a lot of underground scholars are skeptical of this reform. These communities have been let down by these reforms forever, with promises that it will be different, and then more money is just funneled into a system that is already discriminating against people of color and predominantly black folks. Some, but not all, of the educators and facilitators and tutors in Teach in Prison identify as abolitionists. And it's a theme that's came up in all of my interviews. And if we're talking about abolition, it can mean different things for different people. But at its core, abolition is the eradication of the current prison system and a step towards reimagining the possibility of justice. For me personally, abolition eliminates prisons in order to move towards a future built on accountability and transformation rather than punishment and state-mandated violence. It also focuses on lasting alternatives and a more sustainable future. It is deeply informed by our current legal and criminal system, which is shown to be increasingly violent against people of color and immigrants.
With these interviews, there were some different opinions on the program's connection to abolition. As an educator, Victoria teaches the possibilities of abolition in the classroom, but believes Teach in Prison, in its current state, reaffirms the prison system in a lot of ways. But it carries the great responsibility of being an on-ramp to abolition work. Hoping that as students go into San Quentin and see the reality of the prison for themselves and meet with people destined to spend the remainder of their lives inside the prison, then maybe their curiosity for other alternatives will increase. I think Kanisha largely feels the same way.
Work that we do is not abolitionist. I think that's something that we as a group are in agreement on. We think that the work is important. We think that it needs to be done. And also those that are actually incarcerated are asking for it. And that's why we're doing the work. But we acknowledge that at the end of the day, we are working within the state. Every time we go in, that's only because CDCR gives us the sanction to do so. So we acknowledge that what we're doing with Teach in Prison itself, that is not abolitionist work. However, what we are trying to do is create an abolitionist mindset with our decal, but also with doing more than just Teach in Prison, especially what we're trying to do next year, is more direct organizing within the community. And that's where we can do abolitionist work. But we recognize that the work that we're doing is not abolitionist.
But I would assume that everyone in the program would agree on a few basic principles. not all of them, but some would probably include that everyone deserves basic rights. Education and dignity are crucial for personhood, and sometimes we have the opportunity or obligation to do what affirms these principles, especially when larger institutions aren't.
I just want to add that, you know, at the moment, sort of like the Norway fantasy, I think there's a kind of love affair going on a little bit between the prison system and higher education. And I, on the one hand, I applaud that because there is no doubt that if you're going to incarcerate people, that providing them access to quality education is one of the most important things you could do to help remediate the harm you're doing to them and give them the tools that they'll need to destigmatize themselves and to reconnect with the world when they get out. But it should never fool us into thinking that it makes sense or it's a practical solution to continue to have these prisons. I mean, even if we get every prison in the state hooked up with, you know, one of the Cal States or a UC, etc., if that's delaying even for a minute our real effort to sort of downscale that whole system, then I fear that it will be something of a trap. We might become so enamored of our sort of ability to lift people up by educating them that we forget that we're incarcerating them, that we're doing a huge amount of primary damage, not just to them, but, you know, to their children and other people in their community.
Yeah, that was definitely some facilitators of the Teacher Prison Program were struggling with, was like not being able to consider themselves an abolitionist organization by giving validity to prison reform and prison programs. And
I think the actual teaching itself is abolitionist. I mean, I think one of my kind of rules of thumb to sort of try to answer the question that Ruth Gilmore poses of, you know, when is a reform that will just legitimate the system while leaving its main pernicious features intact, and when is it an abolition reform that takes us at least some direction toward a horizon of actually abolishing? And I think anytime you're actually enhancing the dignity of the incarcerated themselves, that's always an abolition reform, whether it's, you know, a better living condition inside, access to education, access to computers and telephones. I mean, right now the most common, you know, prison violation of the rules is to be in possession of a cell phone, and they're ubiquitous. They're like more common than drugs or other kinds of things. And the idea that we should treat that as a violation rather than a right, right? I mean, you know, if you're going to incarcerate somebody in a cell, they at least ought to be able to, you know, talk to their mom, talk to their sister, talk to their brother.
I think that's a necessary perspective, because I think it cuts off people who have good intention from any potential increased quality of life for people that are in the prison. I mean, unfortunately, they're not going away in my time in Berkeley, so it would be nice to
contribute. In your lifetime.
Yeah. Hopefully in my lifetime.
The person that Jonathan Simon referenced in this previous clip, Ruth Wilson Gilmore, is a good starting point for anyone interested in learning more about the complex yet philosophically simple topic of abolition. Kenesha and Victoria's recommendations are Miriam Caber's We Do This Till We Get Us Free, Anything on the Critical Resistance, and Abolition is Love by Cyrus Marcus. The Teach in Prison Program and Underground Scholars Initiative are on campus and always need our support. UC Berkeley and San Quentin sit on opposite sides of the Richmond Bridge. Their physical proximity is undeniable, but their stories have also always been connected. Not always in a positive way, yet there is a future where that can shift.